Hi, I'm Plante on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Gail Anderson Dargatz joins me again. Her new novel, The Spawning Grounds, has just been published. It's a book set in the Thompson-Shuswap region of British Columbia that tells a family story, one intertwined with a place and one that affects and is affected by the nature around them. It's a story that speaks to the theme of legacy, environmental and familial. I'll get Gail, who joins me now, to tell us about her book and these characters she's created. Gail Anderson Dargatz was last on this program 9 years ago when her previous book, Turtle Valley, was published. Her books have been published worldwide. Her previous books, The Cure for Death by Lightning and A Recipe for Bees, were international bestsellers and both finalists for the Giller Prize. Her other books, Turtle Valley and A Rhinestone Button, were national bestsellers. The website for more is at gailanderson-dargatz.ca. The Twitter handle is at AndersonDargatz. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program in Sorrento, British Columbia, Gail Anderson Dargatz. Ms. Anderson Dargatz, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So the relationship between The Cure for Death by Lightning and The Spawning Grounds is what?
Well, first off, it's kind of a time for celebration for me because this is the 20th anniversary of The Cure for Death by Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
I had no real intention of having The Spawning Grounds come out at the same time. It just happened that way. But, you know, I'm writing about the same landscape, and that's the Shuswap Thompson. And I think just because I am writing about that same landscape, many of the same themes came out in The Cure for Death by Lightning. You know, there's the sometimes conflict, certainly tension between First Nations communities and settler communities. That's one theme that's there. One thing I find myself writing about over and over again is how our worldviews affect how we view and treat both our natural world, but also our own spirit, our own mind, our own way of perceiving the world. So those things are coming up again in this book as well. And I have one character, I won't give it away, but I have one character who actually turns up in The Spawning Grounds, who is in The Cure for Death by Lightning as well.
So what people have said about your books is that they're rooted in a sense of place. And this is very much at the heart of The Spawning Grounds. Do you ever wonder how or what you have would have written had you been born or lived elsewhere?
Well, actually, I do think about that quite a bit because my stories are so rooted in the Shuswap Thompson region. I think that was largely because of the influence of my own parents, who were both great storytellers. And so when they took me on drives around this region as a child and later as I took them for drives around this region when they were, you know, elders. They told me stories about each location that we kind of stopped at. So I grew up thinking of this landscape as just absolutely full of story. And, of course, many of the stories they told me were tall tales, and many of the stories they told me were also Shuswap stories that my dad passed on me, because he was a rancher in this region and spent a lot of summers with Shuswap ranchers, and so they would exchange stories. So I grew up with this really interesting mix of Shuswap stories, you know, European stories, Swedish stories, British stories, and came to think of this landscape as full of not just story but spirit as well, because many of those stories were about ghosts that haunted a particular location, but also trickster stories. So there are rocks around this area that have stories associated with them, they're trickster stories. So I grew up with that sense of place and story that were just intertwined. I'm really not sure what stories I would tell if I grew up anywhere else.
Now, I understand that you spent some time in Ontario, is that right?
I still do. My husband's family is from Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitch's mom is still on Manitoulin Island, and so we started going out there about a decade ago and fell in love with the place and ended up buying a summer home out there, which sounds very fancy, but it means we now own, or rather the bank now owns, two old houses. But, you know, we spend the summer on Manitoulin Island. which, you know, when I tell people about that, it seems kind of silly because we leave the Shuswap, which, of course, is this beautiful tourist location, and go to another beautiful tourist location. But it's mostly to stay connected with family.
Yeah.
And I ended up running writers' camps on Manitoulin Island because many of the writers I work with through my teaching practice are in Ontario, and so they were coming up. So we ended up running writers' camps out there as well.
Your part of the world, the Shuswap, is not a place that I've been to. I mean, I was born in Vancouver and lived here my whole life, but I haven't traveled this province as much. And from what little I've read of the book thus far, it is such a beautiful place that the book makes it makes you want to go up there.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah,
yeah.
You should come visit.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing, that you gave an interview to the Globe and Mail, and you listed all these bookstores that you like going to, and so that's the other draw now, I guess.
Yeah, well, there, a lot of those bookstores are actually on Vancouver Island that I listed there. But yes, you know, we have some wonderful bookstores here. Well, the landscape really is beautiful. I think part of what you're seeing in the novel, though, I'm really going to have to give credit to my husband, Mitch Krupp, who's a photographer, and as I was writing the book, we went out into this landscape, and that's what we call a date. We take a picnic lunch and go out into the landscape, and he was out there with his camera, and he took pictures, and I was out there with my notebook looking for details to put in the book. And I think, like most people, you become blinded to the beauty of your own landscape if you've grown up with it and lived with it. And he helped me to see it again, and mm-hmm. helped me to see the magic in it, which I think you can see in the photographs that he took, which are all over my website, and in the video that he put together for me in association with the spawning ground. So you can really see that magic and mystery there in his photos, and that hugely influenced me as I was writing the spawning grounds, that feeling of magic and mystery and, again, spirit that's in his photographs came through in the book.
That's the other thing. You talk about water in the first part of the book and throughout the book, and there's such mystery about it, isn't there? I mean,
I think anybody who's grown up close to rivers and lakes, as I have, will feel that pull that draws us as human beings to water. And, of course, you know, there are world stories about water mysteries. I didn't just pull from Shuswap stories about water mysteries. I pulled from stories throughout the world. And, of course, it's you know, a common heritage that we have. And I think all you have to do is sit near a stream or a river or a lake, and you'll start to feel that spirit there if you just sit quietly for a while. And I think maybe, you know, our own ancestors around the world did just that, and those stories arose from that feeling of mystery and magic that is associated with water.
So the chronologically, the story, I guess, begins in the 1860s or so, when this fellow Eugene Robertson, is that right?
Yes.
He comes to this part of the world. When exactly was that, and why?
Well, we experienced, I mean, I was pulling from real British Columbia history there. We experienced, you know, that gold rush in that time period, and it was the first point at which there was a huge influx of, you know, I guess we call them settler culture. We don't have a really good word for it. Coming in and basically infiltrating this area in a real way. Certainly there were Europeans coming in and many other cultures coming in before that with the fur trade, but that was the first really huge influx. And it was a very damaging time for the salmon in the rivers as well, but it was also a very damaging time culturally where, you know, our First Nations cultures throughout the province were coming into very clear conflict with the settler cultures in a new and pretty profound way. So that was my starting point there. But it was also a starting point for this family as they were homesteading in this region. So that was my starting place. But most of the story, of course, takes place in present day. Mm-hmm. But it does keep going back to that history. And I was trying to get across the fact that we are very much still living with that past now, and of course that's coming up in public discussion right now.
Yeah.
I think we really have to look at that past before we can, you know, move forward into the future.
And so the present-day characters we're concerned with are Hannah and Brandon, their brother and sister, or sister and
yes.
brother.
Yeah, and they're in their mid and late teens.
Yeah, and so Eugene Robertson is their great-great-grandfather, is that right?
Well, it's going back several generations
yeah.
there, great-great-great.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about four greats back.
Right.
So quite a few. And they also live with their own, you know, grandfather. Who has taken over the job of raising them.
Yeah, the mother has died and their dad is elsewhere.
Dad is elsewhere.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a big theme through here is abandonment. So, you know, aside from writing about, you know, the environmental themes and our relationships between First Nations and settler communities, I was also interested in that play of... abandonment, I guess, and also how we view mental health issues, because Brandon experiences, you know, a psychotic break in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of looking at it, but of course there's other ways of looking at it as well and explore those in the novel.
You mentioned Stu, the grandfather.
Yes.
What's their relationship with the natives in the community?
Well, he's both, you know, he's got a long history with the community on the other side of the river. He had a very close old friend on the other side of the river. Again, I won't give too much of
sure,
that away
sure.
Because it's touches on some of the themes and some of the characters who were in the Cure for Death by Lightning. So he's both got a close relationship with the rest, you know, the Rez community across the river, but he's also, you know, grumbling and antagonistic about it as well. He's the old worldview. You know, I pulled out of the many stories I pulled from. I pulled from the Fisher King story, very ancient story. You know, where the old king is wounded and no longer fertile or functional. You know, the old worldview. And that's Stu. He's the old worldview in this novel, and just doesn't want to let go. And by the end of the novel, though, of course he does, and that landscape is renewed.
What struck me about the book, because there's a scene at the beginning of the book where you describe the process of spawning.
Yeah.
And Hannah... sees this and actually participates in getting one of the salmon across, and it struck me because I guess living in British Columbia, even where I live here in Vancouver, this fish defines this place, doesn't it?
Well, there's a saying here in the shoe shop that this is salmon country.
Yeah.
And I think for those of us in British Columbia, we understand the salmon in a deeply cultural way that I'm not sure the rest of the country quite understands.
Yeah.
It's part of our psyche. It's part of our culture. It's a huge part of our economy. And, of course, here I'm living very close to the Adams River, which I'm sure a great many people will assume that this river in the novel is the Adams. It's not. It's a culmination of a great many rivers that I've lived close to, both in the Shuswap and on Vancouver Island and in Ontario. But it's, you know, it's a huge draw to people around the world. We have, you know, people literally coming from all over the world just to view that amazing event of the sockeye returning. And, of course, they're returning in fewer and fewer numbers.
Yeah.
And I think that fact is on our minds. We're certainly talking about it. And it's just an ever-present element in BC life. So, you know, I chose to write about a river. It was natural then that the salmon would be an element in the book.
Yeah, and the physical journey that they take from birth to when they die, I mean, it's unbelievable, really, to think about what they have to go through and where they go.
Yeah, well, the journey of the salmon is literally an epic journey, and I would view it, and many people do, as a spiritual journey. It's remarkable, and the more you look into it, the more remarkable it is.
So when you take that and you take the unknowable nature of water, are these things that you've been thinking about in terms of, say, how it relates to one's life and in the course of writing The Spawning Grounds, did you do a lot of introspection, perhaps, as to yourself?
Well, that's really an interesting question. Again, it took me 10 years to write this novel, largely because of things that were just happening in my life. I was teaching. I had my two youngest late. I lost both parents. I divorced and remarried. I took on two wonderful stepchildren, and so there were all those life changes that happen to us very often in our 40s. And I was thinking about those things. I was dealing with those things as I was writing this novel. And, we talk a lot in, my workshops about the hero's journey, but there's another one, and that's the female hero's journey. And for most women, I think that journey doesn't happen in their youth. It happens in their middle years when they lose a parent or divorce or the kids leave home and they have to strike a new identity. And while in The Spawning Grounds, Hannah is a young person, and of course it's being called a coming-of-age story. For me personally, it was in some ways a way to work out some of the things I was going through personally. Probably the biggest event was losing my mother during that time period, and that was at the beginning of writing this book. And I think you can see that grief manifesting through Hannah, who has lost her mother in the past as a child, and has to come to terms with that and comes out the other side. I think that's the most personal element of this novel. I think as we mature as writers, at least women do, we tend to look more and more outward for our stories, and that's certainly been the case for me. So this novel wasn't a personal one in that way, but that particular element was a personal element. So it's so that was a spiritual journey for me that was linked to all the elements that we've been talking about.
And I guess all writers, because they create the characters and the story, bring themselves into it. And I suppose that's the element of yourself that's born through these pages, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, we even when we don't consciously try to write about a personal story or a family story, I think parts of ourselves do end up on the page, and they have to. But of course, it's also true that the book is a partnership between the writer and the reader. So I'm fully aware that now the book is in print, it's no longer mine. And when someone picks up the book to read it, they're inventing that book along with me. So it's very much a partnership. They'll take their own sensibilities and their own worldview, their own experiences into the book. And of course, that's why it's very hard to recommend a book to somebody else, because if you recommend the book to another person, they're creating a whole different book than the one you read. So it's a very interesting and very intimate relationship between reader and author.
So your book also speaks to the issues that a lot of people are thinking about when it comes to the relationship between our governments and ourselves with the First Nations communities in this country, as well as the environment. These things are, did you consciously set out to write something about that and perhaps say something about those things?
No, and I actually think it's a mistake to start with a message. I'm a fiction writer. My first task is to entertain and tell a good story. Having said that, though, there's a deeper way to entertain. You know, I think if we, many writers want to be challenged as they're reading, and And so, you know, when I chose to write about a river and when I chose to write about this landscape, I naturally drew from what was here. And everything that's in that novel is here. At the same time, though, you know, I wrote a lot of this book, probably most of it, on Manitoulin Island during the summers. And the reason for that, and I think a lot of writers will agree with me, it's very hard to write about your home landscape when you're in it, especially if you're writing fiction, because it's you don't really have the freedom to imagine it as well as you would like. And when you write fiction, whatever your inspiration is, whether it's your home landscape or a personal story or a piece of history, you do need to run as far away from that initial inspiration as you can, in order to, you know, move it past that personal story or that newspaper story and into the universal. So writing this landscape while I was on Manitoulin allowed me to create an imagined landscape, and the locals will certainly tell you that my landscape and in my novels are most decidedly imagined landscapes. You can certainly see the inspiration for them there, and I love to hear from you that, you know, reading this book made you want to visit the Shuswap. But yeah, it is very much a fictional landscape, and these are very much fictional communities. They have to be in order to tell the story.
Would it be presumptuous for me to say that when you go elsewhere to write this, and you're obviously thinking about where you're from and where you live, that it haunts you at all?
Does the landscape haunt me?
Yeah.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. On Manitoulin, we have a lovely old house. It's a very old house, 120-year-old house. And in the living room, we call it our salmon room, and I've painted it that lovely salmon orange.
Mm-hmm.
And on the walls are images of the sockeye from the Shuswap that Mitch took. And in the rest of the house, there are images of the Thompson Shuswap region. So images of around Kamloops and all through the Shuswap, all around Shuswap Lake. So even though I leave that landscape, I'm quite literally surrounded by it there. And when I dream of the Shuswap landscape.
Hmm.
So, and that's been true even when I lived elsewhere. I've lived on Vancouver Island, I've lived in Alberta, and I've spent time, you know, elsewhere. But when I dream, it's of this landscape. So it's very, very much a part of who I am.
As I mentioned, this Globe and Mail interview that you gave recently, there's a line in there, and I don't know if it was Jack Hodgins who told you this, but because this book has taken a great number of years to come to publication, when the book is ready, it will find a home.
Yeah.
And so how do you, because you've written, I guess, four books previous in the first, I guess, 10 years, is that right?
Well, five literary books, and then I wrote several literacy learner books as well.
Yeah, and so
I think we're at something like 12 books altogether.
So this one took a little longer than the other ones, is that right?
Yeah, it did. The Cure for Death by Lightning still took me 7 years to write.
I see.
So,
yeah.
You know, A Recipe for Bees was much shorter. It took me 2 years to write. And this was before kids, too.
Yeah.
It does, with a literary project, it can take a very long time. I don't think it has to take as long as it did with me. I simply had a great many things to juggle. But then that's true for most people. You know, we have work, we have family. And finding time to write is very difficult. It's also sometimes very difficult to justify because it's not an activity that's going to make you money. It's not practical, and it's hard to convince the people around you to see it as a worthwhile endeavor a lot of the time. I was lucky that I grew up in a family where my mom wrote, my sister wrote, and it was seen as something of value. So I always did write. But it is sometimes hard to justify doing that. That's something that comes up over and over again with the writers I work with. And a great many of them don't get around to writing that novel that they've really wanted to write probably their whole adult lives until their children are gone and very often until they've retired. So a great many of the people I'm working with are in their later years writing their first novel. Writing is something that you really need to do for love. It's always a mistake to do it to get published, because your focus then will be on the publication end of it and not on craft. It really needs to be on craft and on process. So you have to find a way to love what you're doing and learn how to do it well. I often liken learning to write fiction to learning to be a concert pianist. It really is at that level of skill. You need to find good instruction, you need to find good readers, and you need to practice and practice and practice. And that means your first novel may not be the one that gets published. I've got several, partly finished projects in boxes all over the place that just didn't make it out there into the world.
So what do you make then of people who get out of college and that's all they want to do is publish and are consumed by that?
I think they'll have some growing up to do as writers. For one thing, writing is one of those few occupations where being older is a distinct advantage, not for getting published, because the publishers very often want the new young thing, and I think that is a real reality. But in terms of craft, you're very likely to write your best work in your later life if you keep at it, because your craft will get better, your perspective will get larger and will mature. I would say the same thing that Jack Hodgins said to me, and that was the number one mistake you can make as a young writer is to publish too soon. Mm-hmm. And it really is the case. You take your time and know what you're doing. You can find publishers who will publish your manuscript before you or it is ready. And that will come back to haunt you. So mm-hmm. just take your time, learn your craft, and be sure of what you're doing. And that can take some time.
Now, I understand that you're now that the book's been published, you'll be traveling the country promoting it. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm doing the local events this week, and then it's off to Toronto and area next week, and then the festival season begins all through October.
Yeah, and you'll be doing some events here in Vancouver, is that right?
Yes, I'll be at the Vancouver Writers' Fest, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Because this book is set where it is, when you go to places in Ontario, other places across the country, I mean, they'll get it, won't they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, it's... even though it's not, may not be a landscape that they're familiar with, I think they'll fully understand, many of the things I'm writing about, the themes I'm writing about there are certainly ones that we're dealing with and talking about right across the country, so absolutely.
So I'm like you, I love going to bookstores, and I printed up that list that you gave, the Globe and Mail, places on the island, and I went to Munro's recently for the first time.
And Munro's is just beautiful, absolutely beautiful store.
And, I mean, what you said about it is, I mean, I'm bereft of words. I mean, it really is almost a spiritual experience walking into that place.
No, it really is. It really is a cathedral for book lovers. It goes beyond just a retail outlet. It's a place to exchange ideas. I grew up in a generation where bookstores were places where you didn't just buy a book, it was where you went to discuss ideas.
Yeah.
And there's many independents that still provide that experience. I'm sad that we may have lost something of that culture, but, I think maybe we may be regaining it, too. And it's also true that a lot of those discussions are happening online. I just love the feeling, though, of walking into a bookstore and knowing that I can engage not just with a bookseller, but very often with other book lovers. And of course, Monroe's is one place where that's very likely to happen.
And in the Shuswap, there's some good places there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I just did an event last night. This is my first face-to-face event on the book in my own hometown, and that's always the most nerve-wracking and always the most fun. And Loy Nachtigall of Buckingham Palace was there, and that's our local bookstore, and he just does, you know, awesome events. And it's the same thing. You can walk into the bookstore and have a conversation about books. It's not just about selling books. It's about an exchange of ideas, and I love that.
So this will be my my way of getting into your part of the world there, is going to these bookstores, and then of course the bucolic landscape, but the bookstores will be the excuse, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we're moving into the season where we get these lovely, you know, mists, and you feel like you're walking into a ghostly landscape too. So I like the idea of doing a tour of British Columbia through the bookstores. I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah. Well, it's been real fun talking to you again, and congratulations on this book, and good luck with it.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure talking to you.
The website for more, GailAnderson-Dargetts.ca. The book is called The Spawning Grounds. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Gail Anderson Dargetts, joined me on the line from Sorrento in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.